All right, so Matthew 22, and we're going to pick up at verse 15. Just recall what that this last section was the chief priest and scribes challenging, elders challenging Jesus by what authority he would do these things, and then he turns and tells them a story about how they're going to, they've already killed the prophets, and has a parable on that. And then the text just before the one we've got here, chapter 22, 1 through 14, he gives the picture of the wedding, the parable of the wedding feast. And in that parable, of course, talks about two different classes of people. Everybody remember who those were? Two classes of people in the parable. Yeah, Jews and Gentiles, and how are the Jews referred to in the parable?
They didn't want to come even though they were invited.
Yeah, they were the ones invited. They were the ones that had been prepared for this, and they find different reasons why not to come. Some of them are just not interested. Others are violent. And so you have those. And then the Gentiles are referred to when he says, okay, I still have room, go out into the highways, go out into the main roads and invite everybody that you can see and find and bring them in. And then there's one guy in the that comes in who doesn't have a wedding garment on. And he's thrown out. So indicating the need to prepare for the occasion. And so that's how he ends that particular parable, and says in verse 14, for many are called, but few are chosen. obviously indicating that entering the kingdom, even for the Jews, was not a sure thing. That they had to do the proper preparation, had to be interested, etc. Alright, so what we're seeing is, this is the last week of Jesus' life. He comes into Jerusalem every day, spends his time teaching in the temple, and he keeps getting these challenges from different quadrants of the Jews. And so now the challenge comes from the Pharisees and the Herodians. Okay, so verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully. And you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you're not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax. And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, Whose likeness is and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, Therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. So he continues to answer each person wisely. Let me give you just a quick background, then I'd like to ask what you see in the text that you thought was interesting to you. First off, this poll tax that you're referring to, the Romans exacted on Judea, At 6 AD, not long after the Romans had taken complete control of Judea and Jerusalem. And once they did that, then they exacted the poll tax, which caused a huge revolt among the Jews, led by a man named Judas the Galilean. And so that particular revolt was very powerful and still was remembered. And as a matter of fact, the revolt led to the creation of the Zealots. Most of us are aware of the Zealots who advocated the violent overthrow of the Roman Empire. In fact, one of Jesus' apostles was Simon the Zealot. So Jesus even had a zealot on his team. I'm sure Simon gave up that desire as he became an apostle. But anyway, that's what creates this. And so you can see their challenge and what they're doing. If they can get Jesus to say, no, we don't need to pay that tax, then then of course they can accuse him before the governor, etc., of taking the side of the zealots and wanting to overthrow Rome and not submitting to Rome, and maybe even following in the steps of Judas the Galilean. After all, this is Jesus the Galilean. So there's a lot of things that are involved there, and of course, if he says pay taxes, then everybody's going to hate him because nobody wants to pay taxes. So, and especially the Roman government. It's not even their government. They don't want to pay taxes for the government. So this is where they have him, they think, in a dilemma. And so there's the challenge. All right, so what are some of the things that you notice in the text that are interesting to you and very critical to understanding the text? Yeah.
I like verse 16 a lot, when it says they sent their disciples to him. It's almost like they're kind of tired of getting schooled over and over again, but okay, they're just going to send their
disciples. You guys go out and see if you can win this battle, because we keep losing. Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Good.
What's the significance of the Herodians being present?
Yeah, so there's an interesting observation. You have a unlikely team of people here. You have the Pharisees and the Herodians, and you couldn't be more opposite, because the Herodians were in favor of Herod's dynasty. And Herod was the king over Judea. He was a puppet king. King over Galilee mainly at this time. There was no Herod over Judea at this very moment. But he was in that position. And so these people were in favor of the Herodian dynasty, and the Herodian dynasty is in favor of the Roman government, and the Herodian dynasty also is very political and is very protective of their power, etc. But the Pharisees, well, they're the opposite of that. They didn't get along with the Herodians at all. They didn't like the Herodians. So to have these two actually team up and plot together is really an unlikely combination.
Were the Herods from Edom?
Yes, the Herods were Edomites by race. And as a matter of fact, had converted, quote unquote, to Judaism in order to take their place over Judea. The Herodians, or the Herods, being king over Judea is an actual fulfillment of God's prophecy through Jacob, or that is through Isaac, when he gave blessings to Jacob and Esau. And when he gave a blessing to Esau, after Esau begged him to give him a blessing, he said, well, your brother is going to rule over you, but at the very end, you will break the bonds. And so this is a little bit of that picture, where here's an Edomite reigning over Judea.
Didn't have a real good resume, however.
No, they did not have a good resume. They were murderous people. One of the Herods even murdered his own mother. They didn't think a thing about murdering their own siblings in order to protect their power. So they were nuts. I think a lot of it came from a lot of intermarriage, too, among them. But they were kooky. It's terrible to have a kooky person reigning over you. The way it was. Okay. What else do you notice about the text?
Well, they puff Jesus up before they ask him a question.
Yeah, and you know, that's an interesting little thing. We know that you are true. You teach the way of God truthfully. And you not care about anyone's opinion, for you're not swayed by appearances. Does that sound like a bad thing?
No.
That sounds like something to attain to, doesn't it?
I'd like for somebody to tell me that.
Yeah, you'd like somebody to tell you that. You know, we know that you're not going to care about what anybody says. You're going to follow what God says, and that's that. And you're not going to be influenced by people, and you're just going to stick with the way of God no matter what.
But are they sincere?
Well, they weren't, but I think they told the truth. about Jesus. And like Dwayne said, yeah, I'd take that on. Let me be called that. That'd be good. I think that's something very important to attain to, because it is difficult not to be swayed by friendships and people around you and things like that. So that's a challenge. All right, what else?
You think they're just reminding, or they're setting him up by saying all those things?
Yeah.
Don't try to wiggle your way out of this question. They really thought they had a great question.
Yeah.
And reminding him of all these qualities, you are these things, therefore you need to be them, when we ask you this question.
Exactly. So, you know, when we ask this, as if Jesus would have lied about it, but when we ask this, we're just reminding you that you need to level with us on this, and go ahead, speak right up and tell us that we ought not pay taxes or not. Either way you say it, we got you. And you know, how many times have you seen Jesus tested and you put yourself in Jesus' position and you think, boy, I would have failed that. they'd have got me good, because, number one, I can't think on my feet that quick.
I'm also very susceptible to flattery.
Yes. Now.
I thought it was interesting that they made a difference between teaching the Word of God truthfully and somebody's opinion. They saw a difference between the two.
That's good. That's a good observation. Yeah, you teach it truthfully, and you're not going to care about opinion. The difference between the truth of God and somebody's opinion about it. Excellent. That's a good observation.
But then they ask him, "What is your opinion?"
Yeah, basically. So, what do you think? Yeah, you're not going to follow anybody else, but we want to know what you think about it. That's exactly right. Okay, what else you see there?
Jesus still calls them hypocrites and characterizes them as malice.
Yeah. Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Okay, so there is the key. Obviously, Jesus just isn't name-calling here. He is making it clear that you are taking a hypocritical stance by asking this question. So, can you detect what it is about their approach here to Jesus that makes them hypocrites?
I would suspect that it was fairly common knowledge that the Pharisees were not great friends of the Romans.
True.
And if they had to try to find out someone else's opinion about it, that would very likely show a high degree of insincerity.
Yeah, well, obviously the Pharisees, there's a way to get out of paying taxes to Rome. They'd have done it.
Exactly.
You know, if they could get away with it, that would have been their stance. Now, the Herodians were the opposite. They wanted to make sure they were done that. Yeah, exactly. So they're not even on the same team on this question as it is.
It would be another suspect situation.
Yeah.
Those two buddying up.
That's exactly right. Okay, let's explore that a little bit more. So Jesus asked what question? What's he tell them to do?
Show me the coin.
All right, so now you need to know a little about what's on the coin. The Jews despised that coin because that coin would have either Tiberius Caesar, or the son of Augustus, or it'd have Augustus Caesar on one side, and on the back side it would say, Son of God. He took on divinity. Okay, so guess who's carrying around a coin that is blasphemous? These very people who are challenging Jesus. They're using the coin. Now, where are they at this moment?
In the temple.
They're in the temple using a blasphemous coin. Hypocrites. Indeed. Are you suggesting, you know, that in any way you are at all consistent in your own lifestyle, and you're sitting here trying to capture me, trying to catch me in my words, and this sort of thing. And so you notice Jesus isn't carrying the coin. They're carrying the coin, which is why he says, well, show me the coin. And then whose image is it? He didn't even answer that question. Well, it's Caesar's. Yeah, well, that's great. So since you're carrying around Caesar's coin and using it, why don't you just go ahead and pay Caesar what Caesar's owed, because you're using his coin. And you can give to God what is due God. This would have been very, you know, to us, that's about as natural as it becomes. You know, we kind of think, well, of course, biblically, God never suggested that you would rebel from, you know, the government that you were under, unless they were, of course, trying to make you disobey God. But other than that, you could easily obey God and obey your government that you're under and not be violating either one. That would be perfectly acceptable. God has made it so that we could live in communist China and still be faithful to God. They might certainly put some pressure on us, but we would look at them square in the eye and say, me being a Christian does not change one bit about me standing for the Chinese government, and I would never try to overthrow it. Now, how about that, Mr. Chinese? So, you know, we would try to appeal from that level. Of course, they don't get that. Communists rarely do. But it doesn't change the fact that we would still be submissive to our government. That we know that. They couldn't figure that out. To them, this Roman government had taken over God's nation. And there is no way we should submit to them. So there you can see how they would be looking at it. Plus, they would have interpreted the prophecies in a very physical way, that we Jews are going to conquer you one day. And so wouldn't have seen it as the spiritual kingdom that it is, as a physical kingdom. And so that would have helped them down the road as well. At any rate, they are certainly hypocrites. And of course, when Jesus answers and goes, well, it's your coin. It's Caesar's coin. You're carrying it around, so I guess you owe Caesar, and you can owe God as well, and you need to do both. And they had a lot to say about that, didn't they? And they just heard it, marveled, and walked away. Went back, their tail between their legs. So that's that.
I wonder how much plotting they had to do to come up with this question.
Yes, no kidding. I just probably sat around for hours trying to figure out, oh, this is it. This is the one that'll get them. Well, he'll never get out of this one. Well, and see, you know, that by the way, that teaches us something valuable. When you're presented with a choice between two directions or two choices, that doesn't mean those are the only two choices. There can be a third. And you let somebody lock you in to those two choices. It's like, have you stopped beating your wife? Well, how do you answer that?
But Jesus, back in the previous chapter, did lock them into choices.
Yeah.
Where's John's authority come from?
Yeah, which was a legitimate.
And they wouldn't answer.
Yeah, there's only two choices in that one, because there's only two authorities. It's either man or God, and so he rightly put them in that situation. In this case, it's not whether you pay, you know, or not pay. It's whether or not you can serve God and serve the Roman government, which you can do both. Okay, next section in verse 23, the same. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Render to God the things that are God's, Caesar the things that are Caesar's. It was Caesar's image on the coin, but we are made in God's image. We render our image back to God.
Well, yeah, true. But again, we're using, and that doesn't change anything. That we're
no,
still
the same.
Yeah.
Wonder if they thought about that.
Thought about that part
they're
of it.
They're made in God's image.
I doubt it. But that is interesting. Here's Caesar's image, and of course Caesar is, by that image and by what was on the coin, Son of God, is challenging God himself. which is the opening of the book of Mark, which is written to Romans, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
So, well, the Pharisee holding the denarius, I would thought that was mine, not Caesar's. You know, I mean, it's a concept.
Yeah, it's a concept.
That he's not afraid of Caesar because he's not afraid of any man and all that.
Right.
But I'm of the opinion that went contrary to what their general idea was.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I've got a bag of coins and, wow, I'm doing good.
Yeah,
know.
Yeah.
But they're Caesar's money.
Yeah, but they couldn't use that money to pay a temple tax.
Only if you got it out of the mouth of a fish.
Yeah, and then you got it out of the mouth of a fish.
What was the time frame with this, probably, and then Jesus overthrowing the money changers?
Oh, this was only a couple days later. Yeah, yeah. That had just happened. This would be like a Wednesday right now. He did that on Monday or Tuesday morning. Yeah, Tuesday morning. No, Monday morning. Yeah, because the entry was Sunday, and then Monday morning he came back. So this is just a couple days after him overturning the money changers. Exactly. Okay, so verse 23, the same day, Sadducees. Okay, so now the Sadducees are watching all this, and they go, well, our turn, and we think we've got the question you can't answer, because we've asked the Pharisees this question probably dozens of times, and they could never answer it. So here's our top question. You ever thought about the fact that if the day comes when we're with Jesus, that we just might have a whole bunch of these questions? Do you have your top question that you want to ask? You know, that kind of thing. Not to try to trap him, obviously, but just be, I'm dumb as a post. I never could figure this out. Would you answer this biblical question? That would be the way I'd be.
I'd be disappearing that crowd.
Yeah. Okay, the same day Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection, and they asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, and having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. So too the second and third down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died in the resurrection. Therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her. So this is, of course, was something that was taught back in Deuteronomy. So that a man would not lose his lineage, and the nearest of kin would marry. We actually have a book in the Bible that followed that pattern. You may know what that book is. Story? Yeah, well, in Genesis, you do have the Judah one in Genesis 38. You have Ruth. Yeah, the story of Ruth also has that principle. So, anyway, they present this like this, and of course they're thinking of things quite earthly. first off, Sadducees, let's make sure we're all understanding who they are. The two major sects, of course, are Sadducees and Pharisees. Sadducees were primarily made up of the priesthood. High priest was a Sadducee. And they were primarily in control of the temple and were very political. So they had a lot of connections maybe to the Herodians and that sort of thing. Would not have been interested in the overthrow of the Roman government. Were quite happy to fit within that. We might wonder, well, how could a bunch of priests, those who believed in God and etc., how could they possibly not believe in a resurrection? I mean, that's just astounding to us. One of the things that helped that along was they only accepted five books out of the Old Testament, the first five, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and they didn't accept the rest of the Old Testament as being inspired. So that would, if you were having a discussion with them about the resurrection, that would limit you to having a passage out of Genesis through Deuteronomy to figure out, explain that and prove that there was a resurrection. Lots of more passages in the rest of the Bible that would talk about it, but or less of the Old Testament, but not so many in Genesis through Deuteronomy. So that would put Jesus even in a more challenging position, because if he tried to cite one of the prophets or something like that, they go, we don't believe the prophets were anybody who was inspired of God. So that's the Sadducees. Just when you look at it, how do you think the Sadducees are thinking about the resurrection in order to ask that question? What makes it absolutely phenomenal just completely untenable that there could be a resurrection from the dead from a Sadducean point of view? How are they thinking to make this, that just can't work?
Purely physical.
Because, it's totally physical. They're thinking of a totally physical realm. They're thinking like, a lot of the shows and movies that have come out in the past number of years, like somebody just walking dead or returns from there all, well, if you come back to life, what are you looking like? So the older I get, the less I want to come back looking the way I am now. I'm like scaring myself to death as it is when I look in the mirror. I don't want to come back with all these aches and pains. And Dwayne especially doesn't.
Yeah, you should have seen me 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. He's pretty then. You just think about it that way. And you go, man, what are you kidding me? I don't come back that way. It doesn't make any sense. So there's just a lot of that would have gone on their minds. And you even see Paul addressing that to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 15 when some in the Corinthian church were teaching there was no resurrection. And one of the questions they had was, well, if there is, what body do they come with? I mean, it's certainly not going to put back together that rotten old body that we saw put in the tomb. It's crazy. So you can see how they're thinking. They're just not thinking above this particular realm. By the way, a question I had for years, why would a Sadducee believe in God and not a resurrection? What's the point? Yeah. Like Paul says, if there is no resurrection, we're of all people most to be pitied. Well, here's the answer. To them, serving God was all about what happens in this life. It was all about serving God, and God would reward you with wonderful blessings and take care of you, and you would be in an earthly paradise, so to speak, and you'd leave a great heritage, and etc., etc. The Sadducees were typically quite wealthy, and they lived for this world. Now, you don't think of anybody in the world today that act like that, do you? No, all the time. All these TV preachers, they preach the gospel of health and wealth, Boy, you send me money and you'll turn out to be the richest guy around and you'll just have the best life ever. Now, like one of those books is The Best Life Now, something like that. I can't remember who writes that, but there was somebody who wrote it.
Joel Osteen.
Joel Osteen, yeah. Your Best Life Now. Can you believe Your Best Life Now? Are you kidding me? Do we not believe in a resurrection, Mr. Joel Osteen? I don't even begin to understand that. You do not have. I pity us if we have the best life now. I don't know about you, it's been good, but if it's the best, let me be like the dog Rover, just dead all over. Who cares, about a resurrection if this is the best life now?
You know, if it's the best life now, then Adam brought it to us.
Well, exactly. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so that's the Sadducees' point of view, just so you kind of understand that. And the Pharisees fought them like crazy, believing in the resurrection. Okie doke. So now we get to Jesus' answer in verse 29. But Jesus answered them, "You are wrong, because you know neither the Scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. So he keeps talking about how they marvel and are astonished at his teaching. So here is this great answer. Now, what do you see in this part of the text that is really cool to you. What's interesting here?
He quotes from a book they understand.
Well, number one, that's exactly right. He quotes from Exodus. Exodus chapter 3, verse 6. So they accepted Exodus as inspired. And so you need a passage to prove the resurrection. Here it is. Exodus 3, verse 6. You notice how he simply says, have you not read, you know, that what was said to you by God, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But we know that comes out of Exodus 3, 6. Okay, when God spoke to Moses. How long had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob been dead when God said that to Moses? A long time. About 500 years. Yeah, 400 to 500 years by the time. So they'd been dead 500 years. And when God appears to Moses, he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that proved the resurrection. Now, I want to know how many of you ever read that passage and would have went, Jesus, God just taught the resurrection from the dead when he said, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We'd all get that, right? That was just the easiest thing ever. Afraid not. Don't you just wonder how many other texts are like that that we've missed? That's what I want to ask you. All right, go through the Bible and tell me all the one things I missed. You know, tell me where I was dumb as a post.
Well, that's like the people on the road to Emmaus had their hearts burned.
Yeah, as he explained to them.
Revealed what they didn't know.
That's right. I'm sure he has that sermon on DVD or something, and I want to hear it when I get there. I'd like to hear that sermon. That'd be good. All right, what else do you see in the text?
Well, there's a connection that they haven't realized between the scriptures and the power of God. And they know neither one of them.
Why is that amazing for him to say that to them?
They've studied this all their whole life.
Yes, they've spent their life with this. This is the priesthood, for crying out loud. These are the people who are responsible for primarily teaching the people. These are the people running the temple. And he says, yeah, unfortunately you don't know the scriptures. Or the power of God.
Did they also not believe in angels?
And Acts 21 actually says they don't believe in angels.
Yeah.
That is one of those things that is, because, you know, the Pentateuch talks about angels many times. So when you understand the Pharisees' view of angels, you can understand why they probably did. That text is probably saying they didn't believe in angels in the way the Pharisees believed in it. The Pharisees believed that one person pointed out, they believed that about 90% of the things that happened in this life was just done by supernatural forces. So they didn't accept much from just natural consequences of human choice and how that went. Like the book of Proverbs is very, very clear that you make these choices and here's generally what will happen. You make these choices and here's generally what happens, which shows that we have quite a bit of control over the things that happen in this life. Now, obviously, we don't have complete control. God is over everything. But on the other hand, the Pharisees looked at things with angels were always involved in everything. And the Sadducees went, that's the dumbest thing ever. And the Sadducees were kind of right about that. The Bible doesn't teach that angels are just controlling everything that is going on. We have some choices in this life as well. So not that they're totally uninvolved either. But at any rate, some believe that that's what that text is actually saying. Not that they didn't believe there was any such thing as angels at all, but that they didn't believe the angels were involved in our lives in the way the Pharisees taught it. So, anyway.
Well, the reason I mention that is he points out that there is a distinction.
Yes.
That the angels are different.
The angels are different. And as you point out, when he says there's neither married nor given in marriage, but are, and notice that real word, like, like, not angels. He doesn't say that in the resurrection we are going to be angels. He said we're going to be like them in regard to the fact that there will not be marriage. So this whole thing of saving up all your genealogies and everything to make sure on the resurrection day you knew who you're supposed to be married to, I don't think is quite necessary. So, at any rate. Okay, so you see that. You know, these scriptures, like Dwayne pointed out, you know neither the scriptures. Then right later, have you not read? Well, of course they'd read it, but they had not discerned it. And again, that ought to challenge us. Just the way he said those things, that ought to challenge us to be more careful in our Bible study, more careful in our reading, to stop and think about what is really being said there. Notice carefully the words. Okay, so why does the phrase, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, prove the resurrection? Did you say the tense?
Yeah, the
present tense, that he's still living. And that's what I've always said until I learned this last week, that there is no verb in the Hebrew. So, we can now throw that out. You even wrote it in your Bible. Yeah, well, I did too. I for years read that and went, well, yeah, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but I am, present tense. So, now if you were reading the Septuagint, the Greek version, it would say I am, but the original Hebrew does not have a verb there. There is no verb. It has to be supplied. Some might say, well, we understood that it would have to be supplied. Okay, possibly. Or look at it this way, that the argument is actually that God made a covenantal relationship with these patriarchs. And if he does not, if they are dead, then he can't keep the promises to them. And the covenantal relationship actually means absolutely nothing. Therefore, to say to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is and which really is the context to Moses, because he's trying to show Moses. Moses says, who shall I tell them that sent me? And who are you? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You tell them I am has sent you. The idea being that the same God who promised your patriarchs, your fathers, these covenantal promises, I am still that God, and if I gave them those promises, they will be able to receive them just as you will. And indeed, when you go to the book of Hebrews, what is said about Abraham? That he did not yet see the promises, but is waiting for them and looking for a city that has foundations. So, maybe that's from those who know the Hebrew. that's the way that might be more accurately understood.
What would a literal translation be? I the God?
Yeah. See, I don't know Hebrew, so I can't answer that. You know, I just all I know is that I've read from a number of different sources of Hebrew authorities that then they'll actually say, we know what all you English speakers usually say, that it's the verb tense, but we're telling you there is no verb in the Hebrew, and so you can't make that argument.
So then what name did God give Moses?
And I don't know. The English is I am, but the Hebrew did not have a verb.
Just I.
Yeah, I don't know. I know what I know, and the Greek has an I am. So
Jesus
which
is quoting from the Greek.
And the Greek is, yeah. In fact, in the text that we're reading yeah. right here in the Greek, there is a verb tense, and there is an I am. So you know, I'm giving you the information. I'm not telling you that I know all about it because, as I said, I don't speak Hebrew. I've taken some Greek, and I know that there is a Greek, that the Greek has that. And so it's translated. So it makes you wonder, well, why wouldn't I just say that it was implied, since the Greek translates it that way? To me, that makes sense, but again, I don't know enough about it to say for certain. I'm just laying some things out for you to look at more clearly.
But it appears to me it's quite plain what Jesus is telling them.
Yes. It's still, the end result is still the same, that he made a covenantal relationship and he wouldn't have said what he said to Moses if it still didn't apply to these men back here 500 years before. So they're not dead. They're not non-existent dead. They still live and waiting for those promises.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Jesus is saying they're not dead.
Yeah, exactly. He's not only teaching us that there's a resurrection. He's also teaching us that they're alive at that moment.
Yeah, just met Moses.
Yeah, well, and the Transfiguration. Peter, James, and John actually met Moses and Elijah, so they were certainly alive. Our Jehovah's Witness friends teach that when you die, you're just dead, and that's it. This text would clearly say that couldn't be. Okay.
Why did they say that some people went to heaven and some people were on paradise
somewhere? The Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses believe they'll be, but they don't believe anybody is alive once they die. I mean, it's just physical. They're dead. And if you're not a Jehovah's Witness, you stay dead. And if you are a Jehovah's Witness and you're one of the 144,000, then you go to heaven in the resurrection. And if you're not, then you live here on a paradise earth. That would be their view. Yeah, there's no hell. Not in Jehovah's Witness view. Yeah, no hell. So when I was living in sin, that probably wouldn't have been a strong motivator for me.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. If I join your group, I'm not going to heaven, and if I don't, I'm not going to hell. Okay, see you. So, I don't know if that's great motivation for me right now. And if I join your group, I get to stay here on earth forever. Yeah, I don't want to do that either. Yeah, you got me. that's not the way I would look at it. Anyway, all right. So there is as much as I know about that, and maybe I messed you up even more. But it certainly messed with me, because for years I have looked at that present tense, and then I read like three different Hebrews authority, and each one of them said the same thing. You can't really legitimately make that argument because there is no verb in the Hebrew. Of course, they're looking at it straight just from the Hebrew. And I'm thinking, yeah, but it was Jesus actually cited it in the Greek as an I am. So that makes me confused. Maybe I'll... when Shane Scott gets here, you know, sure. Shane knows everything, so we'll have to ask Shane. All right. Okay, so let's see how we're doing here. Let's go on to verse 34, unless there's any questions on what we just said.
Yeah. Quick on it. It's amazing to me, like, I could see how the Pharisees and the Herodians just argued over that tax question for years and years, right? No, just a huge argument and no answer, just a debate. Yeah. And then the Sadducees question, again, just huge arguments, debates. It's amazing to me how quickly or shortly Jesus answers these questions.
Yes,
they were also amazed.
It takes him... I just read him.
Two seconds.
Less than 5 seconds to answer this huge question that you just...
Well, one, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that we keep seeing with discussions between Jesus and the Jews is that they, even though, as was pointed out, they spent their lifetime studying the scriptures, especially scribes and Pharisees and stuff, they were bad students of the Bible because they read it incorrectly. Their approach to it was incorrectly, which has been our flaw as well. Their approach was to parse out all the details of how to obey in a particular way, where's the loopholes, what can I get away with, what can I not get away with, put a fence around the law, make traditions, things like this. They were totally involved in that. Now, do we all want to make sure we carefully obey God's commands? Well, of course, He tells us if we love Him, we'll keep His commands. But to study only to find the commandments is to miss 90% of the Bible. There's a context behind commandments. And the best way I've known ever can figure out to explain that is, you know, is a husband-wife relationship primarily based upon commandments? So, you know, like some of you have heard me say...
I can give you an answer later on.
Yeah. But right now I think you need to keep quiet. That's right.
check with me later.
Check with you later without pat around. But as I've said to some of you, the way I got Teresa to fall in love with me is when I met her, I just handed her a list of commandments that I wanted any wife to do. And she fell head over heels. That was it. You know, I didn't even, you know, she just said, please ask me. Now that's silly. You know, that's just utterly silly. That is not the way the relationship goes. And so what Jesus has said in John 6:44, he said, no one comes to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and they all shall be taught of God. God is looking for a relationship where we're the bride and He is the bridegroom. And He has drawn us to love Him in order so that out of that love, we want to maintain a covenantal relationship with Him and we want to please Him and do what He says. We get the cart before the horse. Okay, obey these rules, you're in. And so what do? We obey the rules the same way we fill out our tax return. It isn't out of love that I fill out a tax return. It's out of fear. And not only that, I'm not paying one dime more than I have to. So is this the way we want to approach our service to God? I don't know how many times growing up I'd hear people say, well, do you really think that I'd go to hell if I didn't do that? Or do you really think I'd go to hell if I did that? Or, you know, all these questions. Why are you trying to parse that out? Why aren't you saying this... God is my number one love. If He asks, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to try to see how little I'm going to try to see how much I can do. That would be loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So you see the difference? So if I'm reading the Bible to just see rules, then I'm going to parse it out like a tax return. But if I'm reading the Bible to get to know the one that I'm going to marry, then I'm reading it to see Him and to be astonished at Him and to learn to love Him. And out of that love, show me what you want me to do. Just like when I find out what Teresa likes me to do that causes her to love me more, then I want to go, I'm going to do more of that. I like that.
Isn't it true that, I don't know, it appears that the common people intuitively knew that something was a little rotten with the Pharisees.
Oh, yeah.
And that Jesus appeared and they said, you know, this makes sense.
Yeah. And we'll see that.
Because He's speaking with authority.
Exactly. And we're going to see that in Matthew 23 because I think the crowd still hears Him gladly as He rips the inconsistencies and the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, and how the Pharisees would lay heavy burdens on them in their interpretation of the law and yet not do any of it themselves. So
we may know intuitively how to better behave than Lawyers.
The lawyers. Yeah. So, maybe. Got any lawyers here, Wayne? Okay, so anyway, I think good point there. Verse 34, when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, all right, gonna try again. They gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Don't you know they had that argument 1,000 times? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. So, you know, basically what makes those two laws great is they summarize every other law. You cannot, you know, just like look at, if you looked at the Ten Commandments, the first four of the Ten Commandments are all about loving God. The last six are all about how we would treat our neighbor in a proper way. And so everything is based on that. And it would all hang on that. So any time I would look at any law, if out of that does not come either my love for God or my love for man, I'm probably not understanding the law correctly. I need to reread it. And of course, the Pharisees violated that like crazy, which is evident by the story of the Samaritan and many other of the things that they constantly did. Okay? Any, Matthew is, in fact, amazingly very brief on this, whereas Mark's account is much more detailed, which is a little reversal. Matthew is usually has a lot more to say about it than Mark does. Okay. Yeah.
If he summarized the rest of the commands, then obviously love requires some action.
Yes, and love certainly requires action. That's right. It's not just simply a feeling. It requires actually doing something. To love your neighbor as yourself means I have to do something for my neighbor. I can't just passively say, well, I don't do anything bad to them. That's not loving them. It is a very, very, the both commands are extremely active. And you cannot, even though Jesus will say it both ways in John 14, you cannot only say it one way. A person could not simply say, I know I love God because I keep his commandments. That may be possible. That may be true, but it may not be true too. Because, I'll give you an example of that, and that's the church at Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2. This is a church where God had no criticism of any practice they were doing. In fact, commended them for not allowing false teachers, recognizing that false apostles who came along worked for him, for his name's sake. Served God, was persevering in serving God, did not tolerate the Nicolaitans, which God hated, and their doctrines. All of those, you just go, well, Lord, I mean, they're good. I mean, what's the matter with that? He says, but I have this against you. You have left your first love. I'm not your first love. See, in other words, you can kind of mechanically keep those commandments. But God, that doesn't necessarily mean God is your first love. That didn't mean that he's necessarily the number one. Yeah, I get the commandments done. Like somebody says, well, I made sure I went to church Sunday. Whoopee-doo. That does not exactly equate to loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You can keep all the commandments in a mechanical way and not necessarily love them with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Perfect example. I learned this especially when I had a couple come into my office who were having marriage problems. And she's in tears and he's smug. he's like, I said, what's the problem? Who knows? I don't know. Can't please her. You know, I bring home the paycheck. I don't go out carousing around. I read the paper, watch ESPN, burp at the end of her meals. You know, it's great. I don't know what she had as a problem. And I look at her, and through the tears, she said, "Yeah, you do all those things, but I'm not your first love. ESPN's first love. Golf is your first love. Football is your first love. That's where your passion really is. That's where your love really is. Think about what your passion is. What lights your eyes up? If it's something other than God, there's a problem. And that takes a lot of time and effort. You don't just say, love somebody. If you told me, you got to love this person. Okay, I've been to say, you and I need to get together and I need to get to know you because I can't love you otherwise. I'm going to have to know you. I'm going to have to figure you out. I'm going to have to get an idea of you and grow to that kind of love. But that couple, when she said that, I went, bingo. That is exactly what was going on at Ephesus. That's the same thing. And we all understand that in a marital relationship. And there's been a lot of marriages that are just, they're kind of a great partnership. You know, like Walmart and Pfizer, they get along really good. But they're not the same company. So, there you go. All right, let's look at the final question to finish out the chapter, verse 41. It's not a, this is Jesus' question of them, since he's answered all theirs. Now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question, saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" They said to him, "The son of David." He said to them, "How is it then David in the Spirit calls him Lord, saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet.' If then David calls him Lord, how is he his son?" And no one was able to answer him a word, nor they did anyone dare ask him any more questions. That did that. So you see his challenge? This comes from Psalm 110. In Psalm 110, David said, "The Lord," Lord God, "said to my Lord," the Messiah, "sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." So the Lord says to David's Lord. Well, David's Lord is going to be his descendant. How would David call his descendant Lord? That you don't call your son Lord unless your son happens to be divine. God himself and actually precedes you. And there's the challenge that he lays before them. And of course, that was unimaginable to them, that the son of David, the Messiah, would actually be God himself. They could not ever have dreamed that. Should have been able to by little statements like that. See, again, better student of the Bible would have said, wait a minute, David's descendant is going to be the Messiah, but David calls him his Lord. Of course, there's other passages that would indicate a similar thing. Okay, any questions about that?
What do you think they might have understood about the blessing that Judah received?
Which
scepter
one?
Scepter would not
Yeah, the scepter would not depart from Judah. Well, they really believed that the Messiah would come, would live forever, and, you know, on a perfect earth, and they had a very, you know, again, physical view of that. So
kick the Romans out.
No? Yeah, kick the Romans out, and that whole thing. Conquer everybody. Sure. That's the idea. All right, anybody else?
It's kind of neat to me that the guy who eventually preaches about the same verse as just a dumb fisherman, whereas, you know, these Pharisees are totally stumped by this question.
Yes. Yeah. Jesus hasn't been to any of their schools or anything like that.
I'm not Peter.
Oh, well.
Too, as well.
Well, Of course, this is Jesus saying this right here.
I know, but Peter also talks about it in Acts 2.
Right, okay, yeah, Acts 2 later, Peter does the same thing. You're right. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. So, good, good. All right.
Well, Jesus has been talking to him since he was 12 years old.
Yeah.